got a little bone to pick with the programming department. Would it kill you every once in a while to play a little Fog Hat?
Our final hour of the broadcast week from our remote Carter Subaru studio. Welcome, Sean. I was thinking about letting the music go for about 2 minutes just to freak you out again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it seriously crossed my mind, but we have too much stuff to do. I can't be dilly-dallying like that.
Well, there's always next Friday, Dory, to pull a prank on your old buddy Sean. Live on the air.
Darn sure. Okay, Jay Inslee is going to once again destroy the final half hour of my show for the third consecutive day. He's called a 2:30 press conference. And if you were listening yesterday, we actually dumped out of a lot of it because they're getting really boring. But it's also hugely important because he says he's going to have details on when we're going to move out of phase one and into phase two and how we're going to get our lives back and start rebuilding the economy. Have an update for you out of San Diego before I get to my guest. Guy down San Diego, he broke into a Wells Fargo bank at 3:30 a.m. two nights ago. And the alarm was triggered. Police were dispatched. Police got there. They saw that a window next to the drive-through had been broken into. But it wasn't what it may have appeared to be on the surface.
Bizarre break-in at a Wells Fargo in Choiceview. Our 10 News breaking news tracker was there as he was being taken into custody. The man explained to us that it wasn't the safe that he was after. It was the bank's microwave.
You did that for a Hot Pocket?
Yes. All that for a Hot Pocket.
You broke into a bank for a Hot Pocket?
Hot Pocket.
For a Hot Pocket. Was it worth it?
Hell yeah, it's worth it. Yeah, it's worth it. A Hot Pocket? Hell yeah.
It's when he sings the Hot Pocket song that it really kind of grabs you there. He has not been identified.
Hot Pockets. Yeah. I used to have some semblance of a voice. Hot Pocket. I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm starting to sound like Don Imus in his final days on the air.
Dory, do you know who Jim Gaffigan is real quick? Jim Gaffigan.
Yeah. I always think about Jim Gaffigan whenever I hear Hot Pocket.
Got it. That's all I wanted to add to your monologue there, Dory. That's all.
Here, let me try to redeem myself. Hot Pocket. Why can't I hit the lower note? You'd think it'd be the higher notes. That's weird. Isn't that weird? Hot Pockets. There we go.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, with that as painful preview or prelude or whatever I call it, let me get right to our big lead.
The big lead. Your tax dollars at work.
Well, as you know, of all the things that have really infuriated me, during the economic part of this COVID-19 crisis is the difference between private and public sector. You know, we're seeing 20 to 30% unemployment coming in the private sector. Jay Inslee still has not made any cuts at the state level. And I saw a story on King 5, Eric Wilkinson did it, about the city of Edmonds, which hasn't laid off anybody. And not only that, but the workers who are sitting at home, some are getting bonus hazard pay. The public works director is Phil Williams for the city of Edmonds. He joins us here on the Dory Monson Show. Phil, I appreciate you coming on with me this afternoon.
Certainly.
Okay. So I want to make sure I understand this, because what I got from the King 5 report is city of Edmonds has 250 people, workers on the city payroll. You have not made any layoffs, or the city. It's not your decision. The city has not made any layoffs, correct?
I'm not aware of any layoffs that have been made, no.
Okay. And one of the council members there is very critical, saying that a lot of those 250 workers are sitting at home, getting paid to do nothing. As the director of a big department in the city, is that a fair characterization?
Well, I think there's a truth in that, but I would point out the rest of it being that the other six members of the city council approved the program on the 24th of March in all of its parts. It's been executed exactly as the plan had been laid out, and it's been successful. We have not had any additional cases of our employees contracting the virus, and that was why we designed the program the way we did. And by doing that, it has allowed us to provide all of the essential and critical services that a municipality in this state has to provide without having our people come to work sick and contaminating the rest of the crew, because we could have easily...
I mean,
We could have easily ended up with almost nobody at work, and then
all of the
essential public services wouldn't be provided.
Yeah, no, I'm working from home as well because it's safer. A lot of us are,
right?
But it is safer to work from home. So why are they getting a 6% bonus for hazard pay?
Hey, let me tell you, my employees in the Public Works Department do not work from home. They are out there every day with hard hats on and working in the city right away, taking care of signal systems and streets and sewers and water systems. And they can't do that from home. So they need to come to work. And
but the
thought
people
was
working
the
from
council
home,
provided. What's that?
The people working from home are also getting hazard pay, I understand.
Well, I think you could talk to our HR department if you wanted to get some specifics. But the bottom line is that if someone has to come into work part-time, in other words, they will be exposed during the week to either pick up materials to then take home or work here for one day a week or 2 days a week, yes, they did get a reduced hazard pay payment for that. The people that are out there doing this for an entire week at a time, working physically in the field, are getting 6% additional for hazard pay.
But you told King 5 the ones at home on call are also getting hazard pay.
What I told King 5 was something quite different than that. I think the council member that they spoke with gave a short answer to it, and I don't think it was particularly clear what was actually going on and what the policy actually did.
Well, I mean, I'll just read to you from their article. They're talking about you, Phil Williams. They said, Williams said those getting paid to stay home part of the time were essentially on call and expected to come to work if a colleague fell ill, mainly police and public works employees. And then they have a direct quote from you. You said, if there was a wave of coronavirus, we had to be sure we had backups to take their place and keep the people safe. So
that is absolutely correct.
Okay, so the people who are sitting at home are getting 6% hazard pay while they're on call?
No, they are not. And I would really love to clear that up for you and your listeners.
Absolutely, that's why I called you.
The people that came to work, we did split our crews into two groups, right? Because we didn't want one group to infect another. We tried to keep them completely separate so we could continue to provide a shorter list of emergency and critical services. And we didn't want those crews working side by side during any given week, because if somebody comes in sick, as we had very early in this episode, we had a parks employee show up that had COVID. We had to send 16 people home as a result for 2 weeks. So that was what we were trying to prevent. We kept two crews active that were separate from each other. If it's your week to work out in the field, then you would get your full pay plus a 6% hazard pay when you went home.
Even if you're not out in the field?
No, listen to me. I'm talking about
public work. I'm trying to make sure I understand. So if it's your week to work, because there are times, since there may be days go by where they're not called out into the field.
You got a group of people that are at home, and they are being paid to stay home, stay healthy, and take care of themselves, and be prepared to come back to work the next week. The people that are working that week in the field doing work are getting 6% hazard pay. The ones that are at home are not. They're not getting any hazard pay.
Okay, so
when they come back to work, they'll get the 6%.
And when does that come to an end, the hazard pay?
It already has.
You're not paying it anymore?
No, as of Monday, when people come back to work, that, well, actually, no, the split shifts end on Monday. Let me be clear about that. The split shifts, everybody's going to be back to work on Monday in my department.
And the hazard pay ends then?
No, I don't think it does. But I, again, I'm gonna refer you perhaps to our HR department, or we could do a phone call back. But my understanding is the hazard pay will continue until the governor's order, the stay-at-home order, has been lifted.
All right, I understand. Look, I understand much better than I did going in, because I think that I got some information that's certainly not consistent with what you're telling me here. So,
well, and let me say, I'm sorry if I had any edge to my voice here during this call, but I've been getting a lot of calls about this, and I think, frankly, the information out there really wasn't particularly accurate.
Well, but that's why I always reach out to the people that, I mean, because I was furious when I saw this story, but that's why I always reach out to the people I'm going to be talking about to get their side and present their side. So I'm glad you were able to do that.
One other thing I would like to mention, I know Edmonds for some reason just got, the city of Edmonds got highlighted for this, but I would guess most of the cities I am aware of did something almost identical to that, and for the exact same reasons. And the whole point was, we can't take the day off or the week off. These are critical services. If you don't have water and sewer systems and streets and signals and,
no,
and street lights and everything functioning, you know, the city falls apart. So
but I,
we
but
have
I have
to
a
ensure
much,
that.
We don't have time now, but I have a much larger issue with that when our state government shuts down our economy and instantly creates 20% unemployment, and the public sector doesn't take any hit in unemployment rate, and they say we're going to give our employees even more money because of this. The disparity between what the private sector is going through and what government is going through could not be more stark.
But you do understand the missions are entirely different, the private sector versus the public sector. I mean, we are providing the services that the city needs, whether it's the economy is running well or whether it isn't running well. Those services still have to be provided.
I know, but for every one of my listeners who's unemployed, their livelihood is an absolute necessity for them as well.
Of course it is, but I assume when they are home...
That's not in any way disrespecting what those of you in government work do. I just say the disparity right now between private and public is it's mind-blowing to me.
Well, you know what? There are differences between public and private employment. I absolutely agree with you. But our missions are different as well.
Got it.
I think that needs to be part of the picture.
Phil, I enjoyed talking with you about this. I really appreciate you taking the time.
You bet, Dory. Anytime.
All right, Public Works Director for the City of Edmonds, Phil Williams. Let us know what you think about all this. You can text us at 98973. Up next in the Big Lead.
The Big Lead, top story.
And if you are among the 1.1 million unemployed, I'd really like to hear from you if you want to text in. Because, and Phil's a good guy. He came on, answered tough questions. But I always get the sense that government thinks they are better because they're government. And the lives that you lead in government and public work is not more noble than the lives of the unemployed, the people who, you know, work as bartenders and waitresses, the people who, you know, work in our hotels and... They can't get through the state unemployment hotline because of gross mismanagement. And, yeah, what you do is important. But what family providers do in the private sector is every bit as important. So it's different, but not one's not more important. And there's no way the private sector should have 20% unemployment. And government, which, yeah, the public works people, people who keep our lights on, keep our sewers flowing, keep water pumping, essential. But every single layer of government, whether it's the city of Edmonds, Seattle, King County, Washington State, has such bloat and so much crap that they pay for. And when everybody in government says, oh, no, we're not taking any hits at all, that's all for the little people in the private sector. It drives me crazy. And again, this isn't about Phil. Phil's a good guy. Anybody who comes on and knows I'm ticked off about something and will still come on and answer tough questions, awesome. But Every job's important, government and private sector. Okay, up next in the big lead here, tomorrow afternoon, there are a couple of major protests planned in downtown Seattle over the George Floyd death in Minneapolis. Now, as you no doubt have heard, the officer who killed George Floyd, and I have no problem saying that, he has now been charged with third-degree murder. Everybody I know in law enforcement universally condemns what that cop did, putting his knee on a handcuffed man's neck. And we're all in agreement. And justice is happening swiftly. Charges less than 4 days after the incident happened is, you know, the prosecutor, the attorney back in Minneapolis said that's unprecedented. They have never filed charges this fast, but that's because their city is burning the last couple of nights. And not by protesters, but by rioters. Tomorrow, there are protests planned in Seattle. And I know the motivation of the organizers. They say it is to be a peaceful protest. And what I find really, really interesting about this is that Jenny Durkin, Carmen Bass, Dow Constantine, Jay Inslee, people who have been taking away constitutional rights in a literal sense for the last 2 months because of a health crisis. Jay Inslee says you couldn't gather at church for 2 months. The First Amendment of the United States Constitution says Congress should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Government is not allowed to prohibit the free exercise of religion. Jay Inslee said, yeah, but we're in a health crisis and I'm the governor and I can overcome the First Amendment. The Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution. Private property shall not be taken for public use without just compensation. And Jenny Durkin, Dow Constantine, Jay Inslee said, oh, unless you're a landlord and you can't evict people, even if they still have a job, if they just don't want to pay you all of a sudden, you cannot evict them because we're the government and we are taking your private property and we are not going to give you just compensation. And Jay Inslee says, well, it's because of a health crisis. I'm not going to allow the Fifth Amendment right now. But they're going to allow a series of demonstrations in downtown Seattle tomorrow. They won't let you gather at church. They won't let high school seniors have an outdoor graduation ceremony. But they're going to allow protesters in downtown Seattle. When we have seen it erupt in violence, this morning in Denver, a protester jumped on a woman's car. She accelerated, knocked him off, and then in terror, she swung around and hit him again with her car and then raced off with the dozens of people in pursuit. And these protests have turned into riots in Minneapolis. And my question is, Jay Inslee, you've suspended the First Amendment for church services for 2 months. You continue to tell us that you are going to prohibit public gatherings. The right of the people to peacefully assemble shall not be infringed by government. You have suspended the First Amendment. You've suspended parts of the Fifth Amendment. Why are you allowing a protest that in other cities has turned into incredible violence? Why is this the only thing that's going to be allowed? And I'm not saying they should stop the protests. I'm saying they should let high school seniors have an outdoor graduation ceremony then. I'm saying they should let people go to church then. But because of political correctness, they're afraid. They're just afraid to say, oh, we can't say no to a George Floyd protest in downtown Seattle. And so they're going to carve out that one exception. And I think that's a dangerous path to go down. All right, Jay Inslee, going to destroy the last half hour of my show. Planned press conference minutes away. We'll take you live to Olympia coming up on the Dory Monson Show. Yeah. since I did the yeah at the beginning, Sean, I can go silent for 2 minutes now, and you know that I'm dialed in.
That sounds real good, Dory.
Thanks, Sean.
That was a quick 2 minutes.
And time flies by. Keep this going. Keep this going. So for the third consecutive day, Jay Inslee has scheduled a 2:30 presser down in Olympia. Nicole, any movement since yesterday when you told me on the air that Jay Inslee might do a one-on-one with us next week? Nicole?
She should be there.
She doesn't seem to be.
Yeah, maybe her phone's so muted. She's potted up.
This is
bizarre.
I'm trying to make a case that I want to do my show from home forever. So we have to really, in the next few weeks, minimize any of these things. We need to clean it up here. So, yeah, yesterday, apparently, Jay Inslee's media person said that we, the Dory Monson Show, are on the list of people. Whoa, what happened there?
Oh, sorry, I had to restart the bed. Usually I'm better at looping, but I didn't put much effort into that one.
No, you sure didn't. So we may get an interview with Jay Inslee next week.
Oh, sorry, my mic is still on. Nicole's here, Dory.
I told Sean I was taking the dog out.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Jeez, what a disaster.
We're well polished today, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Wait, the dog couldn't wait until 2:55?
Hey, do you ask dogs to hold it? I don't know. He was by the door. He needed to go. My roommate's gone.
So I was trying to ask you, have you broke the news yesterday that we may get a one-on-one with Inslee next week, and I was just asking if there's been any movement on that front.
Yeah, no movement yet, but I hear that they're still finalizing his schedule for next week, so that's why I was supposed to check in on Monday.
What's your best guess, percentage-wise? What do you think the odds are? Because I've got mine. What do you think the odds are?
I say maybe 60%. I think we're over 50. So I'm going to give it a 60.
Do you really?
Yeah, I really do. He's never told me no.
I'm going to go 5%. It's a 1 out of 20 shot. And then the trouble for me is I don't know how much time they'd give us. I have so much to ask him. I don't even know where I would start. I think I know what my first topic would be. And that it would be $30 car tabs. We've got people who are financially devastated. The voters overwhelmingly said, give us relief on our car tabs. And he's telling landlords, you have to give up your private property to help people during this crisis. But the government won't take the tiniest haircut of giving up car tabs because of the criminal syndicate that is Sound Transit. And so I will publicly declare that that'll be my first question so they can adequately prepare for it. But I remain disgusted that all of these people who are unemployed and they're getting Sound Transit $300-$400 car tab bills. One of my daughters who has a 10-year-old vehicle just got a ridiculous car tab bill. And again, she asked me, Dad, should I pay this? I voted for $30 tabs. And everybody's hurting financially. And so I can't imagine what the answer is, except that they consider government more important than the private sector. So
I feel like every time you go off on one of these, our chances go down a little bit. But hopefully we're not jinxing it. I mean, I know he's not paying attention right now, right?
Well, but so do I have to turn into a little wissy guy for a couple of days to try to suck up to the gov?
No. Dory, have you...
I don't think he expects that.
Have you thought about if he declines the show, which would be unfortunate, if you just get in it on the press pool and ask a question during these Governor Inslee press conferences? Like,
The problem with that, I have thought about that. The problem with that is the press conference every day is at 2:30, and I've looked at the rules and regulations. You have to call and get in the queue at 2:15, and I can't do that because I'm on the air. So just the timing of all of these press conferences. But you know what? I don't even want to do that because these press conferences are a joke. The reporter asks a question, then they're muted. They can't ask a follow-up, and the governor at times does not answer the question. And so I don't want to engage in some exercise of frustration. And so
plus, it would just seem desperate on your attempt then too.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Well, and they don't have to call on you. So
that's right.
I'm not a media pool guy. I'm a one-on-one guy. Exactly. We've reached a certain level of prominence here. Okay, while we're waiting for this 2:30 press conference, have you gotten any updates on why they're running so late, by the way?
I have been told that they were running 10 minutes late, but I haven't been told why.
Okay. Well, tell you what, because I have so many things I haven't even gotten to yet. Yesterday, I talked about how Donald Trump said to Twitter, he issued an executive order on this Section 230. And I told you yesterday what that's all about. But back in the late 1990s, I think it was 96, when social media was first coming to be, Congress passed an exemption that companies that eventually became Facebook and Twitter have taken great advantage of. And that is, you are just a pass-through. If any of your people on your site, if they post something on Facebook, if they post something on Twitter, Facebook and Twitter cannot be held legally liable because they're neutral. And that's how it's all designed to be. Cairo Radio, Bonneville, Seattle. If I say something that is slanderous on the air, Cairo can get sued for what I say. Same for a newspaper. If they have a reporter or a columnist who writes something that is slanderous, libelous. TV stations, the same way. But they carved out a special exemption for social media. And they said that because you are neutral and you're not imposing any editorial will on content, that we will give you an exemption of liability. And then recently, Twitter and Facebook, absolutely, congressional Senate hearings proved that Facebook tried to greatly influence the 2016 election for Hillary Clinton. They were doing all kinds of push notices for Hillary. They're trying to get out the vote the day of, and they, by millions of voters, they influenced the election. They just weren't able to swing it over to Hillary. And Twitter right now says we're going to be a censor of Donald Trump. We're going to put warning notices on his tweets. And yet the Ayatollah Khomeini, or whoever the supreme leader of Iran, can declare jihad on Israel on Twitter. And Twitter says, go ahead, we're neutral. But, you know, Trump says mail-in voting can lead to election fraud. And Twitter said, oh, this could be false. Here are links that prove it. And links to left-wing media outlets. So now Twitter's decided it's going to just be a left-wing censor of anybody they don't like. Well, you don't get that liability protection then. So I was talking about this yesterday, and all these people were just blinded by their hatred for Trump. So don't you recognize Trump lies? So is Jay Inslee. Jay Inslee lies when he says he won't raise taxes. Jay Inslee lies when he says the COVID death rate is increasing because of lack of social distancing, when it's increasing because of increased testing. And they don't put warnings on any of those things. So, yeah, people are getting tired of this one-way social media. Jay Inslee just sitting down to his presser in Olympia. What does it mean for reopening the state? Is he ready to go, Sean?
Yes, he is.
All right, let's take you to Olympia Live.
News for the state of Washington. And that good news is that based on a central premise that if we remain diligent and committed to fighting this virus, We have now new effective ways to fight this scourge. And because we have these ways, we can now begin to open up more businesses and enterprises in our state. And this is because we have new tools and we intend to use them. A Washington State Stay Home and Stay Healthy order will end at midnight this Sunday, and it will be replaced by a new proclamation based on our Safe Start recovery program. These are next steps to recover from the COVID-19 scourge. This is a path that will have more businesses opening. It means more activities will be allowed, and more flexibility will be afforded counties in a variety of phases. You'll also be seeing a lot more people wearing masks as we continue to work together to protect ourselves and, importantly, other people in our community. Health Secretary John Weissman is here today to answer questions, and we're also joined today by Dr. John Lynch of the Harborview Medical Facility to help us understand the science behind the protection of masks. Thanks to millions of Washingtonians pulling together, and they have, amidst this sacrifice and suffering, which has been profound and deep, people really have been doing their part as part of this initiative in the state. And I think some people, might have, because they've seen fewer deaths than we might have otherwise had, because we were able to send back the Army Field Hospital, because we were able to return 400 ventilators, that somehow we'd made a mistake by being vigorous and aggressive. I think these actions don't tell the story of how the state got it wrong. I think what they show is how we've got it right, because we have had progress. And we know that if we continue in this diligent phase, we can prevent this virus from springing back up. And today is another step to make the transition over time from the social distancing, which is so difficult, to the very acute and smart tool of doing the things that are necessary to maintain our efforts in reducing the transmission of this virus. So we plan under this initiative to move Washington State forward on a county-by-county basis. And under this new approach, counties will have more flexibility to demonstrate that they have the capability to stay on top of the virus. And we'll make those judgments based on the metrics that I'll have a chance to talk about here in a moment. These metrics entail really a holistic view of how threatening the virus is in our individual counties and how well we are prepared to use these new tools of testing and contact tracing in isolation of people when they are tested, and using masks to prevent transmission. Now, this does not mean, obviously, that we're returning to normal. It means that 3 months to the day after we've declared a state of emergency, we're successfully moving forward. As of Thursday, 26 counties have already been approved to move to phase two in our effort. And counties in phase two, as you know, will need to demonstrate for 3 weeks that they're ready to move to phase three. We're in the middle of that process. So as part of this initiative, we've really listened to the scientific community and to our constituents and citizens across the state to set a criteria designed by public health officials to be able to evaluate counties that to look if they have the safe benchmarks for reopening. The Secretary of State will have the authority to move counties forward or dial them back, depending on these metrics. Local health officials, too, I should make clear, have the ability also to lead on this should they decide there's some additional restrictions that are necessary because of the particular circumstances of their county. So here I want to just take a few moments to walk you through what the criteria is that the Department of Health will be looking at. By the way, I think it's important to realize these metrics, I'm going to go through some of them, but these metrics will be taken as a whole. And these goals are targets. They're not necessarily individual requirements. Each will be evaluated in their totality to make sure that we can really move forward. First, we're looking at COVID-19 activity. And the target for new cases will be 25 or fewer per 100,000 residents over a 14-day period. We'll also be looking to assure that hospitalizations for COVID-19 will be flat or decreasing. Those things are related measures, but they have some differences as to timeliness as well. Second, the Department of Health will look at healthcare system readiness. The target will be for available hospital beds in a given jurisdiction would preferably be at less than 80% of capacity to make sure we have capacity should the virus spring back, as it has, unfortunately, in a number of communities and nations across the world. Third, we'll look at the testing capacity. Counties will need to show that they have adequate testing capacity, and the target will be having 50 times as many people per day can be tested as been confirmed per day. That equates to a positive test rate of just about 2%. They'll also need to show a rapid turnaround time for those testing. And that's really important because we know that people can be infective even before they have symptoms. So this timeliness of getting this testing results is very, very important. Fortunately, we've been able to increase our testing capacity recently, and we're very pleased by that. Next, we will look at our ability to do contact tracing. And this is very important, obviously, because if a person is positive, we want to get to the people they've had close contact with so that they can be tested very quickly, and they can protect themselves and their family through isolation as well. The target here is to contact 90% of the cases, the contacts, by phone or in person within 24 hours of the receipt of a positive test. And there's a target of reaching all of that person's contacts within 48 hours of getting a positive test result. This is one of the most important parts of our ability to be able to open up more activity to make sure that this works. Participation in this process, as we've said, is voluntary. But we sure need everybody on the team here because we have to break these links in the chain of this transmission. Now, to do that, the people who are positive are also going to be very helpful by isolating themselves for 14 days and their households. And that's necessary so that it would be just really sad if we have a person with a positive test and they go out and infect their coworkers or their neighbors or the like. And we'll need our county officials to have about 80% of those people will be contacted daily to encourage these families and to support them while they're going through this two-week period. Next, we want to protect the vulnerable. We got to make sure that the number of outbreaks reported by week defined as two or more non-household cases where transmission occurred at work or in congregate settings or in institutional settings. The target is zero for counties under 75,000 and no higher than three for the largest counties. Again, it's important to realize that we need 3 weeks for counties to move from two to three so we can evaluate how we're doing. And so far, frankly, that's gone well. We've been pleased. The counties that have gone to phase two, we've seen good compliance and good results. So that's some good news. So the earliest any county could potentially move to June 3rd or phase 3 would be June 3rd. The Secretary of Health will use these same metrics for a county to be eligible to move to phase 3, as well as information from each county on their experiences going through phase 2. Now, there's another part of this that we're pleased to talk about, and that is we're giving more counties more flexibilities to move ahead in our four-phase self-start approach. And we're going to be open to options presented by counties who don't quite meet the phase two requirements, but might be able to propose certain activities that they can really demonstrate are safe. You might call it sort of phase 1.5, if you will. People might be able to do things like, haircuts or larger outdoor classes or the like, and those will be judged on an individual basis. Okay, now, so we're very excited about this next step. But a really important part of this step, and I want to take a few moments talking to Washingtonians about this, because I think it's a little bit maybe new to us, but of increasing importance. And that is the importance of facial coverings is one of the important parts of this strategy. I'll have Dr. John Lynch talk about the effectiveness of facial covering in a moment. But I consider this really good news that we have now shown that facial coverings can be very effective in protecting the other person. When I wear it, it can protect you. And that's really good news because we can protect other people. When we do an individually small thing, it can have a huge impact on another person's life, namely that they don't become infected. And we know that each one of us can be infected, and we don't even know it because we know we may have no symptoms forever and still be able to transmit this disease. So when we wear a face covering in public, in grocery stores and retail stores as they reopen, in our places of work, I really think a face mask, a face covering is an expression of love. It's an expression of affection for the people around us. And you might think of it as a badge of commitment. It's a badge of commitment to each other to keep each other safe. And I think it's something that we can be proud of when we do this. And we can be pleased that it has now been shown to be an effective and critical tool in moving forward. So we're implementing new and necessary guidance for workers to wear, at a minimum, cloth facial coverings on the job, except when you're working alone in an office or a vehicle or at a job site, or when a job has no other in-person interaction. Employees will need to provide facial coverings for their employers will need to provide these facial coverings for their employees. And as well, when we go shopping now, we're going to see signs, asking us to wear these face coverings. And in fact, I think we have one of those. If it's not up, it could be. So please wear a face covering. You're helping to protect folks, and it'll be a friendly reminder to all of us to help do that. On the job, employees may choose to wear their own facial coverings at work, provided they meet minimum requirements. And depending on worksite conditions, higher level of protections may be required. Our Labor and Industries has provided guidance on those specific items. So this will take effect on June 8th. By the way, the friendly reminder are stores. It's something we're going to require stores to provide that friendly reminder. And we look forward to that success. Again, this is something that the more we all do this, the faster we're going to be able to get back to normal and open up all of our activities in the state. So I'm just really happy that we've got something we can do individually to pitch in here. With that, I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Lynch for some comments. Dr. Lynch, could you share some science with us?
Certainly. Thank you, Governor Inslee. Just double check if you can hear me okay.
You bet. Sound great.
Thumbs up? Okay. Yeah, so thanks so much. As Governor Inslee mentioned, my name is John Lynch. I'm an infectious diseases doctor at Harvey Medical Center in Seattle, and I'm on faculty at the University of Washington. And I've been working on the COVID-19 response really since we had that first patient back in the middle of January. I have to say, I'm in agreement here. I'm a big fan of using masks. It's what we've been using in our hospitals across UW Medicine and many other hospitals in the state now for many weeks, not only in taking care of patients, but in taking care of each other. So what are the things that have really influenced this? I'd say one is our understanding of the virus. So SARS-CoV-2 is the virus that causes COVID-19. We've really learned a lot over the last weeks and months. The second thing is, as Governor Inslee mentioned, we are changing how we're doing things. If everyone stayed at home and was only being around their family, then masks wouldn't play as much of a role. But as we move from phase one into phase two and other phases, right, that physical distancing is rolling back slightly. It's not going away, but it is going back slightly, and this is a tool they can use to mitigate that. And as Governor Inslee also mentioned, this is just one of many things that we're going to use to help protect ourselves and each other. So one of the kind of science background part of this is that we have learned that a lot of people have minimal symptoms, and are infected and can transmit the virus. People have talked about this idea of asymptomatic cases. Still out as to whether people are asymptomatic during the entire duration of their infection or it's really just before they develop symptoms. But in either case, those people have no symptoms right now, and they may be able to spread the virus, and they don't know it. And the same thing happens with influenza. This is not unique to this particular virus. And so putting a mask on people all the time, regardless of symptoms, helps potentially interrupt that chain. The next part is that this virus transmits via these droplets, right? These could be heavy droplets or little droplets. These are the bits of water that come out of us every time we talk, we sing, we cough, we sneeze. And that can happen when we have symptoms or we don't. And again, a mask is very effective at capturing those droplets when they leave our mouths or our nose. So those are the two biggest parts, and we really think those droplets are the main driver of transmission of this virus in the community. So how do masks function with given that information? Well, one, they protect others. So if I have no symptoms and I potentially am infected and I'm coughing or sneezing, a mask on me helps stop many of those droplets. Not perfect, not all of them, but most of the big droplets potentially leaving my face and my nose, and the mask captures that. As Governor Inslee mentioned, that's really important. It protects those around me, my family members, my coworkers, and in my case, my patients. It also protects me. Again, it's not a perfect tool, but it helps stop droplets from hitting my face from someone who may be coughing around me or sneezing around me. And then lastly, this is an indirect effect, is that it also helps me from stop touching my face. So if I'm out in the environment and touching a surface, you know, touching things out in the world, as we are all going to be doing more and more of, this helps prevent me from touching my nose, my mouth, and potentially transmitting the virus. So that's really, really effective. So when you think of those three things, those are really the science-based reasons that we want to wear masks. But I also want to echo Governor Inslee's point that if we are wearing this, we're sending a message to those around us that we're taking this seriously, and we want to do something for our citizens, our families, our coworkers. It really means a lot. Just a couple of quick things here is when these masks are on, right? A lot of these masks work really well. The multiple layer cloth masks you can make at home or buy in a store are really effective, but they need to stay up above your nose and go below your chin. And they really want to be quite snug. We don't want floppy masks on folks because that doesn't work nearly as well. We want to wash our hands before and after we put them on and take them off so those masks stay clean. Obviously, keeping your hands clean is really, really important. And also, we want to recognize that there are people who can't wear masks. Right? There are people with certain disabilities out there, especially small children, particularly under two, and people with specific health concerns. So we want to support each other around wearing masks, but we also want to be thoughtful that some of our fellow community members can't wear them all the time. And again, I'll just...
You are listening to a live press conference in Olympia. Oh, man, we got to get this economy back up and running. It sounds like it's going to start happening a little bit sooner, which is... absolutely necessary. This is KIRO FM, Tacoma, Seattle. I'm out for the week. Tom and Curly are going to pick it up right after the Inslee press conference is done. I hope we can get back to work soon. Hope we can get this economy running again. Take care. Have a great weekend. God bless you in these crazy times. Back to Olympia we go.
Just a couple of things. I want to follow up what the doctor said. It's really important, I think, for people to understand that this thing, we're just not done yet. This thing can increase dramatically, very rapidly, and you're seeing that in various places around the world right now. And that what we've learned is that we can prevent this from coming back and increasing dramatically again, but only if we replace what we were doing, which was having some considerable success, and as we remove that tool, to replace it with another approach. And you might think of it as we were on a kind of a lifeboat for a couple months of social distancing. We're now getting out of that lifeboat, but we got to get another lifeboat to get in, and that's going to call contact tracing and wearing masks and the like. We got to make sure that boat doesn't have holes in it. So that's why the next stage of this, we're really pleased that we can give more counties flexibility. And we're confident that people are going to take on this challenge, and we feel good about that. I do want to... And by the way, if anybody has any questions about masks, too, the doctor was very eloquent, but there's a couple statements that I found very inspiring about masks. won by the Republican governor of North Dakota, Doug Burgum. You can check that out. Won by the Republican governor, Mike DeWine of Ohio, about this subject. This is something that can save Republicans and Democrats, and that's really a good day. Last, just a friendly reminder of the things the doctor talked about and things that we can do. There's kind of four of them. One, we can continue to stay home when it's not necessary, particularly if we're in a vulnerable group. People of my age and people with significant vulnerabilities, boy, if you can avoid exposing yourself, we hope that you will do that. Obviously, wearing a mask, staying 6 feet apart, washing our hands, these things work. And by the way, staying local is really gracious. I know we got so many great places to go in Washington right now, but for instance, I talked to the mayor of Leavenworth, a fantastic town. We just love going there. But for the moment, not going to these centers right now and overwhelming these communities, they really appreciate it. There'll be a day we can get to all these wonderful cities, but right now, let's try to stay home as much as we can. I just want to take a moment to comment, too, on a broader context, and that is that we know that the COVID pandemic has exposed inequities in our society. We continue to see them. The death of George Floyd in Minnesota is a reminder that, to us, state violence has no place in our society, and we've got a lot of work to do to remedy the centuries of inequity of our society. And I think that this pandemic has demonstrated this because we've got to do some things to help folks. We've done something recently to provide more safety for agricultural workers. We've done things in the past to work together to reduce unnecessary law enforcement violence. People work together on that. So I know we want to keep going in that direction. With that, I want to happy stand for questions. And John Weissman and the doctor is also available.
First question comes from Rachel with AP.
Hey, first question is for Secretary Weissman, and then I'll have a question for you, Governor. Secretary, once a county applies under these new benchmarks, is there an estimate on how long a decision on an application will take? And what's the likelihood that counties with very high rates per 100,000, like Yakima, will not even be able to move into a modified phase one? And then for the governor, previously you had said you wanted to ensure there were enough testing supplies and capability for when people start returning to work. And that initial goal, I think, had been around 20,000 a day. Where does that stand as of today?
Well, I'll just go first on that. So our testing capability, as you know, we've had the ability to analyze about 20,000 tests. So that's in good stead. The challenge has been to get the swabs and the test kits, the transport, viral media, and the like. That has improved significantly because we have received some recent shipments from the federal government. We think if that supply chain continues, we'll be in pretty good shape to be able to do the requisite testing. That is an if, however, though, because that supply chain has been fragile and some things we've been promised have not come through. So we just have to increase the stability of that supply chain. The state is buying material. The federal government has been of some assistance recently, but we've got to have a more stable system for months ahead. We have what you might think of it as confidence for the next month, but we've got to have more confidence in the months to come.
Great. And in terms of the earlier question, so how long will it take to evaluate applications? It's going to take probably a few days at least to evaluate these applications. We're anticipating a number of these probably coming in about the same time. We want to thoroughly evaluate those. We want to have conversations with the local health departments. Again, we may have questions about the application, but we also want to make sure that we fully understand their capabilities and capacities and that of a community to effectively control and continue to suppress this virus. And those measures that the governor talked about are going to be really important. And we don't anticipate, folks being able to meet all those measures. So we're going to want to have follow-up conversations with individuals. And of course, in part, depends on how complete the application is as well. But we're going to do our best. We know that folks are anxious to open up businesses again. We're going to do our best to turn those around as quickly as we can, but carefully. As the governor said, the virus really helps dictate where we can go, and that gets to the second part of your question. those counties with really high rates, we're going to have to be extremely cautious about how we move forward. And wanting to continue to work with them and have all of us do our part to prevent these outbreaks, to get control of these outbreaks. And one way we can do that is, as the governor said, wear face coverings. If you need to be out and about, keep your distance, wash your hands. So we'll be hearing what those counties have to say. Again, the counties are going to be the ones who sort of start this process and propose to us what they think is safe. We're going to really be counting on those health departments, and we're going to be counting on those local elected officials to be working with their health departments around what they think is a safe way to move forward.
If I can just add a little bit, this is sort of a county-initiated program for contact tracing and isolation and the like. And the reason I say that is that the state has provided just maybe under 1,000 people that are ready to help counties do this. But they do need to ask and help set up the infrastructure to do this work. And that's really important. I just want to stress this, that this is the counties have a really important role here. And we're going to, we need, it's kind of like a Missouri situation. You need to show us that this is really working, because we can't sink the first lifeboat till we know the second lifeboat actually is working. So we're looking forward to counties' help on this.
Next question comes from Joe with the Seattle Times.
Well, one question, but I'd be curious to hear from both the governor and Secretary Wiestman on this. How did you end up on the 25 new confirmed cases per 100,000 a number for this new set of metrics? Because just a couple weeks ago, it was 10 or fewer infections in that two-week time frame per 100,000 a county. Why was that lower number good then and the higher number is good now? And are you concerned that if a bigger county like Snohomish moves forward, you'll see an outbreak?
John, you want to go first?
Sure. So as I think we've said before, we really started out with very conservative measures. We initially started allowing counties who had 75,000 or fewer folks with no cases in the last 3 weeks to move forward. Again, we wanted to do this safe start. We wanted to learn as we went through the process around how well this worked for folks. Then we went to the 10 per 100,000 population, which again was still a conservative number. And honestly, these numbers will vary day by day. If one has an outbreak and you have a relatively small population, those numbers, quickly change. So the 25 per cases per 100,000 population, again, still seems like a conservative number. Some of our colleagues around the country are using that number as well. California is, and as you know, we're having conversations with Oregon and California and Washington as we do our approaches. So it's really a best sort of public health conversation at this point around what we think makes sense given where we are. We've seen good progress with the work we've been doing so far. And it gets down to, the ability of the system to handle these numbers of cases. And if we can do the case and contact investigations for each of these with these numbers, which we think we can, that then seems like a reasonable place to be. So there is no magic number here, and that's why, as the governor said, we're going to look at all of these measures together. And there isn't one single measure, as we've been consistently saying now for weeks, that is the magic thing that says, hey, this is the right time. So we're taking a look at cases. We're taking a look at hospitalizations. We're taking a look at a community's readiness for case and contact investigations. We want to really look at the whole.
Yeah, I feel I've been really well advised by John and Dr. Lofi, Scott Lindquist. I've just got great advice going through this, but I'll just share my kind of thinking on this in addition. We received some modeling information just a few days ago from the Institute of Disease Modeling, and it showed some really good news, which led me to have more confidence that this transitional period to go to this new type of tool could be effective. I want to show you a graph. Is it up there? So we got a graph that will show you This is from the Institute for Disease Modeling. And basically what this shows is the reproductive effectiveness number that's also called the R-naught number. And basically what it means is it shows the number of people that one person will infect. And the purple line shows Western Washington, and the red line shows Eastern Washington. You'll see on the left, it started out quite high at just under four, so that one person would infect just under four people when we started this challenge. And because of Washingtonians doing great work, we've been able to bring that number down. When you get that number down below one, it means the total infections will decline over time. If it stays over one, the number of infections total will increase over time, or the rate of infections. So that one is very important. And as you've seen, the at least for Western Washington, it looks like that R-naught number has been under one, and that's very good news. And particularly this is the good news, is what the modelers told me, is that this indicates that even when people have increased mobility, that means they're going to work more, they're traveling more, they're seeing their friends more, we've been able to reduce that number. And the reason is, they think, is because Washingtonians are learning new habits of social distancing, that if you do visit somebody, make sure you stay away from them. Wear a mask when you go to the grocery store. And that has been really encouraging to me, to think that the getting into this new boat can be effective. So that was gave us additional confidence this week to move to that number.
Next question comes from Austin with Northwest News Network.
Governor, going back to that modeling, which you've had the benefit of seeing evolve over the last several weeks, there are also scenarios that suggest that this could flare back. And I know you've said the worst thing that could happen is, you know, there'd be all this sacrifice and then this comes roaring back. What would you say to Washingtonians about preparing for a one step forward, two steps back?
What I would say is that this is, I'm sorry, did you have something else, Austin?
No.
Okay. But what I would say is this is under our control to make sure we don't go back. And this is one of the good things about this, is that our destiny is in our hands. Each one of us can be a leader. Each one of us have the ability to do relatively simple things that can protect ourselves and the people around us. And so if we don't want to go back, there's some really relatively easy things we can do, the kind of things we've talked about. So this is really a good news story. We have the capability not to have to go back. It depends on all of us to be leaders. It doesn't have to be an elected official to do heroic work here. Actually, it's not heroism because it's not really that hard. But what I would say is there's no reason that we should have to go back if Washingtonians continue doing what they've done, which is to be really responsible and compliant with our obligations as citizens and really showing a bit of compassion for our neighbors. And if we keep doing this, I feel good about this at this point. But we need to keep doing those things. Now, we do have to realize if this comes roaring back, yes, we may have to take actions that are, again, uncomfortable. But by gum, we've done this once. I don't want to do this twice. We now are in a place where I think we can take the next step, and that's what we're doing today.
Great. Next question comes from Jerry with the Everett Herald.
Am I on now?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Jerry.
Governor. So I wanted to get the impact on moving to phase three and lifting of the order, or letting it expire, on schools. Will counties be allowed to let schools reopen in some fashion, hold some activities, especially those in phase three, where gatherings are allowed with up to 50 people? Maybe graduation ceremonies for small schools would take effect. And I think there was the stay-at-home order that limited the size of gatherings. So if it's gone, is there any limit on gatherings?
Well, we still have limits. They continue as they were, except for the ability to have transition. Schools largely are handled in their own lane, if you will. And so we're going to make some individual decisions on education. And those final decisions have not been made. I've had good discussions with Superintendent Rechtel in the last few days. There's a really good input process going on where we're listening to Washingtonians, parents, educators, citizens about the decisions as we move forward on schools. And those are going to be largely made in kind of their own contacts. I've also had discussions with leadership in our colleges. I think they're coming up with some very realistic potential options. Those are going to be handled in their own lane.
Next question comes, Next question comes from Drew with King 5.
Good afternoon, Governor. Why has it taken so long to come out with the mask directive? People have been going to work and grocery stores for months without them. And unlike what's happened in King and Thurston County, where they've announced these directives, there hasn't been any enforcement there. Will the state actually have some teeth to this directive?
Well, I'm sorry, Terry. Oh, yeah, excuse me. Terry was just telling me Jewel Sachs is on the phone, too. Well, there is teeth, but I just want to start answering this question by saying the biggest teeth is a matter of heart, and that is Washingtonians have rallied to this cause big time. It has not required large enforcement actions because the vast majority of Washingtonians have followed the guidance, and that's why we have been successful. Now, we have had to have some enforcement actions. We've closed, by legal requirement, several stores in the last week, several gyms. They were going to have to pay some fines if they didn't close, and so they closed. So we have had to do that, but it's been a very, very small number of things where you had to move to an enforcement action. But there is requirements in this order. Stores will be required to post a sign asking people to wear a face covering, and that is a legal requirement if they're going to reopen. So there is an order, if you will, but this is a matter of common sense and commitment and compassion, and that's what's really going to drive this issue. Now, as far as the decision, when this was done, look, the science, this has always been an iterative process. This was a new virus, as we all know, and we have learned a lot about it. And just in the last few weeks, the science has become abundantly clear that masks are effective, even the sort of cloth mask. That science was uncertain for the first couple months of this pandemic. It has become clear, and so we have responded by increasing our commitment to this. Now, that has been also more important, again, as we move away from the social distancing. Now masks become more important. They are our lifeboat, if you will. And so that's the reason we made these decisions now.
Okay. Next question comes from Jim with the Spokesman Review.
A couple of questions, Governor, if I could. To follow up on what Drew just asked, that stores are required to post a sign saying masks are required, but will they be required to refuse service to anybody who doesn't wear one? And on something that you said earlier, I'm wondering what will happen if there's a disagreement between Dr. Wiesman and local health officials on dialing back of some activities because the numbers go up in a county and that local officials would prefer not to do that.
Well, the order does not require retailers to eject someone, but it does require them to encourage people through use of this sign. And we think that's the right balance to try to encourage people to move forward. And we think we're going to get large compliance with this because it just makes sense, and we know it's working. And it is becoming culturally kind of the norm in this regard. So we look forward to success on this. Your second question about if there's disagreement, well, the State Department of Health still has decision-making capability, and that will remain on these issues. But we listen to counties, and we'll listen to their arguments and positions. Ultimately, the State Board of Health will have ultimate decision-making. Now, with this exception, counties do have the ability to add restrictions to their counties. They can't remove state-imposed restrictions. They do have the right to be more restrictive. So they do have the right to make decisions about masks and other things that add efforts or add restrictions. And that will remain.
Next question comes from Hannah with Cairo Radio.
By the way, there's one other thing I should add. Under our order, retailers have the right to prevent someone from coming into their establishment should they not be wearing face masks. That has always been the case. This will not change that situation.
Hi, Governor. Just a couple of quick ones today. One, I'm wondering, you spoke about gatherings and where everything, but those are still limited as far as how much gatherings can go. Can you speak at all to, as we're entering summer, what is the gathering rule for our kids who want to get out of the house and sleepovers and play dates and things like that? Where are we standing on those gatherings? And then also, where do you stand at this moment on calling a special session as far as timing goes?
Yeah, the play dates, essentially the same, by and large, gathering rules obtain unless the county changes those by an application. Now, that may happen. I think we've evinced an increasing flexibility on that to maybe allow some larger gatherings under what you might call phase 1.5. Those will be evaluated county by county as requests might come in by the State Department of Health. I do, the children thing is, look, we understand how eager our parents and children are. I know my grandson has been eager to visit a couple of his friends, and we understand how important that is. I suspect over time there'll be some more flexibility in that regard. But I do want to say that, look, this thing still remains dangerous, and I hope people are being cautious about their grandkids mixing it up with grandparents, particularly that transmission. You can have a perfectly robust, pink-cheeked little 11-year-old, but he can infect grandma really easily, and I hope people are being really careful about that. People still continue need to show care for themselves and their families. Special session, we're having some discussions. I've listened to legislators to see if it makes sense, to see if there's any consensus that could actually produce a meaningful product. We certainly don't want to call special session unless there's a reasonable chance that actually would produce a valuable decision making. So we're in discussions with legislators, and there's no sort of final decision on that.
Next question comes from Jim with the News Tribune.
Governor, based on the new criteria, the counties of Pierce, Whatcom, Benton, and Franklin get a green light to go to phase two. And then I had a question for Secretary Wiesman, which is, if a county does have to go from phase two, phase three, back to phase one, especially given the R-naught numbers in eastern Washington, what would have to happen for those counties if they don't want to go back, that the state would require them to go backwards?
I guess I'll go first. I think you said you listed some counties and you said something to the effect that they have a green light. If you said that, that's not the situation. They have the ability to apply at this point, and should they have adequate reaching of targets to show confidence, then they'll be able to move forward. But it's not a slam dunk. They still need to apply, and they still need to see the ability to meet these targets. And those are serious things. Being able to meet the contact tracing goals that we have and the ability for families to be supported while they're, isolating at home, those are really important things. And so they'll have to show a capability to move forward. So it's not an automatic green light. It's the ability to take a look at their metrics.
And similar to what the governor just said, if somebody's in phase two or three and we're seeing the situation decline, seeing, more community transmission of this virus as compared to being able to identify it to a specific, we can identify where somebody got the virus, the infection, or we start seeing the healthcare system really becoming overwhelmed, or the case and contact tracing system break down. Those are all the conversations that I would be having with the local health departments. And frankly, as they get these approvals, they're also, those approvals sort of are contingent upon them watching for that in their community and having a conversation and notifying the State Department of Health, notifying me if they're seeing any of those concerns. So it will be a conversation. It will be us looking at the data, understanding the issue, understanding what might be done to further suppress the virus. And there will be very much a conversation around that. But in the end, and those conversations usually lead to public health folks pretty much seeing the situation the same and probably coming to the same decision. But in the end, if for some reason that doesn't happen, and in the end, I am sufficiently concerned and those conversations are had, and there isn't agreement, then I will have the authority to sort of act and am prepared to do that if it seems necessary.
If I may talk about Yakima County in particular, we care about all our counties. Yakima has a particularly spot in my heart because it's where my three sons were born and where Trudy and I raised them for a couple of decades. And I am extremely concerned about our people in Yakima right now. The infection rate is about 481, I think, per 100,000. And in contrast, some of our counties are in single digits. This is an extraordinarily dangerous situation in Yakima County right now. And we are very, very concerned that if we do not take some additional steps in Yakima County, that it could become even more explosive. To that end, we have dispatched a strike team a week or two ago to Yakima County to work with the officials to see what we could do to get on top of this to decrease the transmission rate. We're glad we've done some things. The order we had yesterday to increase hygiene in our agricultural industry, we hope that's going to help. We've had new testing requirements and assistance to the long-term care facilities where there's been outbreaks in Yakima County. And you know, I'm glad we've been able to do these things. But I just want to level with the people of Yakima because they're my former neighbors and I care a lot about them. We are only going to be able to stop this from getting into the broader neighborhoods of Yakima if we all sort of get behind in this wagon and push. You know, if we continue, if we don't wear face masks, if we don't socially distance, if we still sort of shrug this off as a plot, not a real threat to our families, we're just in a really dangerous position in a beautiful community, and it is a beautiful community. So I am very hopeful that people will pull together in Yakima. I spoke to the mayor of Yakima today about this. I asked her to help to encourage people on this masking issue. I'll tell you, it just makes me really concerned. I talked to a friend this morning about this, that only 30% of people, maybe that's just an estimate of people, are wearing masks when they go to the grocery store. Look, when you have hundreds of infections, an infection rate that's the maybe the highest in the Western United States, we owe ourselves more. And so I just really hope that leaders in Yakima, including family members, can really pull together on this because it is the most dangerous spot in the state of Washington right now, and we'll do everything we can to help out.
Time for a couple more questions. Next question comes from Essex with Cairo.
Yes, Governor, a question for you and a question for Dr. Lynch. For you, Governor, you've spoken so much even now about the importance of wearing masks. But if it's so important, again, why do you leave it to voluntary compliance except for out of the workplace? And for Dr. Lynch, you know so many of the workers on the front lines, and this is so crucial to those healthcare workers. Are you sure that this opening now is not too much too soon?
So first off, this is a legal requirement, as you alluded to, for retailers, for businesses and employers. They are required to provide masks for their employees. It's a very important requirement to protect people's safety. Shop owners are required to encourage their customers. We thought we would get greater compliance in this mechanism than an actual order. You know, we're not going to be sending people out to handcuff people walking into bookstores. What we are going to do is hope that they can consider why this is a badge of honor and a badge of caring about their community. And that educational component, we think, will actually get us more people wearing masks, so we think it will be more effective. I hope that's the case. Now, at a later date, it could be, you know, we could try a different approach. But we've seen a lot of really good compliance. We hope that people will respond to this request.
This is John Lynch. Regarding the second question, I mean, when I look at the metrics that the Department of Health and Human Services and Secretary Wiesman and Governor Inslee are looking at, you know, the use of masks have the ability to impact at least four, if not all five of them. The opportunity here to decrease disease activity, decrease the need for contact tracing by decreasing the number of cases, decreasing the risk of vulnerable populations as we wear these and more of our community goes out to the markets and other stores, and also increasing health system readiness. So by wearing masks in the community, that keeps our hospitals safe and prepared to take care of those inevitable cases of COVID-19 that we're going to see anywhere in the state. It may be one, it may be two, it may be many more, depending upon where we are. But it is the addition of the masking that's going to put our communities in safe positions as we venture out, as we use the, you know, continue to use physical distancing, but in a way that's different than it was before. Using things like contact tracing and effective and easy access to testing, all those pieces together create a community that I think is much, much safer for hospitals to be able to function effectively in going forward. But again, I think that you know, the Department of Health and the governor are going to be looking at all of these metrics regularly, all the time. And may dial up, it may dial back. I mean, I really have to defer to the governor and the secretary on those decisions. But as a healthcare provider in a city that's, you know, was hit pretty hard early on in this, I feel that we're in the right position to move ahead using the tools and the toolkit that is being described today.
Okay, great. Next question comes from Daniel with the Inlander.
Yeah, I guess my question is there's been a lot of situations where there's been these big outbreaks at specific factories, specific locations. I'm wondering what ability the state has to inform the public when of the location of these specific outbreaks, or those restricted by privacy laws.
John, you want to answer that?
Sure. No. So many of these are certainly public, local public health investigate these outbreaks, oftentimes reports on them in the media as they find an outbreak, whether it's at a food processing facility or a long-term care facility that they're working with. The important thing, I think, is that public health get in there quickly, that we are notified quickly, obviously, of any positive cases, that the strike teams are sent in to help folks control the disease, get people tested, so that we can find out who else might be either infected and not have symptoms at the moment, make sure that they are able to get the support they need to be able to stay home and away from others. So these become, you know, oftentimes reported in the media by local public health and are certainly public information.
Last question. Final question comes from Keith with COMA.
Governor, going back to George Folk's situation, the governor mentioned to take over, bring in the National Guard. What's your thought on that? Are you prepared for the weekend of them? Or even starting tonight in Seattle, you prepared? Have your thoughts on it using the State Patrol National Guard?
Well, I have not spoken to Governor Walz. I have a lot of respect for him. I know he's making some very difficult decisions. I hope they're successful. Obviously, we like to have an ability of people to express some very strong and legitimate passions against inequity and unnecessary law enforcement violence. That's understandable, and people ought to have a right to express that. We hope that that's not in a way where people get hurt, and that's everybody's hope. In our situation, I haven't been briefed on any additional threats in the state of Washington. If that arises, we'll make the right decisions. But I hope people can find a way to really demonstrate this is not acceptable in our society. It will not be tolerated. We have to be more action-oriented against this unnecessary law enforcement violence. And we've done that in the state of Washington. I'm very proud of our state. It's got one of the best laws in the United States. That happened because people worked together last year to pass a bill in this regard. And we've been very committed to training our law enforcement officers in de-escalation tactics so that these tragedies do not occur. And we're going to continue in that effort.
Any last words, Governor?
No, I just want to close my comments that our decisions today are based on confidence in Washingtonians. We are confident in Washingtonians accepting these new tools at our disposal to reduce this horrific transmission. We're confident that people are going to pull together. We're confident that we can make changes so that we can reopen our communities. And I'm happy to be able to express that confidence, what we're doing, and looking forward to the next steps after these. So with that, please wash your hands.